HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 63, recorded Tuesday, May 1st, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Scott Guthrie and Jason Zander at Mix about Silverlight.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, the podcast that doesn't waste your time. And we're over here at Mix in Las Vegas, and I am fortunate enough to be sitting with Scott Guthrie and Jason Zander. Scott, we know that you control all things. If you type using and you hit control space, you pretty much are everything there. Jason, you were actually at Dev on the core CLR team and now have risen to a power broker.
Well, I was one of the original developers on the CLR starting in 96. So a small set of us started working on it then. So I'm a general manager for the CLR team, compact framework, ASP.NET, other things like that, working for Scott.
Oh, awesome. So everyone's talking about the Silverlight surprise. Someone actually called it the Silverlight surprise out in the hallway. And it's cross-platform, CLR, Mac people are wandering around Mix running .NET code on their Macs.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a fun surprise to drop on people.
I thought some people's brains were going to explode. It's pretty fantastic.
It was definitely, you know, it's fun when you're doing a keynote and people are wondering what is going to come next. You know, and that was, I think we had a little bit of that yesterday.
So there's the Silverlight story. There's beta. There's 1.0 beta and there's 1.1 alpha, and all those bits are up at Microsoft.com/Silverlight. But the cross-platform thing, to make that happen, people were speculating tiny CLR, micro CLR, totally new written CLR, but you guys have done something different.
Yeah, well, what we've done is we're shipping a Silverlight 1.0 this summer, and that's basically focused on media scenarios, and it only has a JavaScript programming model. We're then going to go ahead and ship 1.1 later, but their alpha of 1.1 is available for download now, along with Visual Studio tool support for it. And basically, in the 1.1 release, we are including a CLR engine. And the CLR engine we're using is actually is based on the same code base for the full desktop CLR. So it's not a tiny CLR. It's not a compact framework version of the CLR. It is actually the same CLR execution engine that you're using with .NET today.
So it's the 2.0 CLR. So it's generics and collections and all that good
generics,
stuff.
Generics, it has collections. It has the same garbage collector. It has the same jitter. And the same type system. And one of the benefits that means is that you can actually compile an assembly. And if you use the same, you know, framework libraries, you know, that same file format and that same assembly can be used, you know, both in the desktop engine as well as within Silverlight.
So are we going to see prescriptive guidance coming about whether it's appropriate to start moving computational work that happened on the server side, like validation and data transfer objects and different business objects, and moving those over onto all those desktop Pentiums that are currently hanging out and not doing any work?
Yeah, well, so certainly going forward, you'll see, you know, much more prescriptive guidance as to, how you use all the different, app patterns that we have. You know, I think one of the important things that people should make sure to understand is, you know, Silverlight in many ways doesn't replace things. It's really enabling new scenarios that weren't possible today. And so there's definitely, we still absolutely expect people to be building, full desktop apps using WPF. Absolutely, you're going to be building server-side apps with ASP.NET. And, you know, what we're trying to do with Silverlight is enable you to run .NET in the browser and go ahead and kind of merge some of the best attributes of both worlds and integrate nicely into, you know, an overall solution.
Right. I mean, certainly if folks have .NET on their desktop, they can exploit .NET all they want. Mm-hmm. But in your demo, you took an XP box, and I think it was just an XP gold disk. It didn't have anything on it. You're running IE6.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like it had just been booted up fresh. No mm-hmm. .NET framework on it of any kind, 1.0 mm-hmm. at all. And you went click, click. And suddenly you were running .NET in the browser.
Yeah, one of the things that we've done with Silverlight, and you'll see us take the same install technology to the full .NET framework going forward as well. But with Silverlight, one of the things that we did was really try to make the install experience lightning fast. And so, you know, in general, once you have the bits downloaded, it's about a 10-second install experience on a clean machine. And that does not require the .NET framework on the machine. It does not require any codecs on the machine. It literally is. You take a fresh machine, 10 seconds, you're good to go.
There wasn't that whole 3 minutes, what is MSI doing
Correct.
Yep. kind of thing. I mean, it was actually so fast, I ran it 3 times because I didn't know that it did anything.
Yeah. We've heard that from a few people. We got to somehow make it more obvious that, like, oh, it worked, because a lot of people keep saying, like, well, okay, I guess it must have crashed because
Well, yeah, I mean,
7 seconds and it's gone.
It takes longer to remove shareware than it does to get this thing on your box. I mean, it's just butter. It really installed like butter. Yeah.
And that's certainly kind of an experience that I think, you know, it's critical for, I mean, the types of scenarios we're going after with Silverlight are to really kind of enable kind of ubiquitous web apps on the web to take advantage of this. And you have to have that kind of a completely seamless install technology in order to make that happen.
Now, one of the things that you said a moment ago was that right now in Silverlight 1.0, the kind of engine, the glue is the JavaScript inside the browser, but outside Silverlight. Mm-hmm. But we're going to be enabling JavaScript inside Silverlight, inside the browser. So you're going to have managed JavaScript like JScript. What other dynamic languages are going to be in there?
So one of the things that we announced, yesterday is this new framework library we call the Dynamic Language Runtime. And it's just it's an assembly that provides a whole bunch of infrastructure support for enabling dynamic languages and dramatically simplifies writing new languages on top of .NET. And so we'll support that with Python. We have our Iron Python compiler that we've already shipped in the past, JavaScript, a dynamic version of VB. And then one of the things we also announced yesterday was that we're supporting Ruby through a new compiler that we're building called Iron Ruby.
So this means Ruby in the browser, but also the DLR, because it's not actually, I mean, even though it's called the DLR runtime, it doesn't modify or patch the CLR. Like you said, it's just an assembly.
Yep.
I can reference it on the server side to start calling
Absolutely,
Ruby.
Yeah, you can start using
mix and match.
You know, Ruby on the server side. You can use Ruby inside WPF, and obviously you can use it inside Silverlight. So, you know, from a language perspective, if you love Python, you love Ruby, you love C#, you love VB, where .NET's the place to be.
Yeah, one of the big things, and we should say that's also available on CodePlex right now. You can download the source code. But the big thing we were trying to do with the dynamic language runtime was take some of the elements that came out of the Iron Python work that Jim Hoogan had done and said, how can we, just like we did with the common language subset and the CLR originally, make it really easy for a dynamic language author to go build, you know, new languages that can share and take advantage of the built-in functionality. And so as soon as you sit on top of this, you get, you know, dynamic dispatch and, you know, type interaction and things like that you'd otherwise have to go write yourself. And you might wind up with kind of a walled garden approach where, you know, that dynamic language didn't understand this one. This kind of bridges that gap. And then because it's all written with, you know, the same CLR underneath, it's the same file format, same IL, you can use the debugger, set breakpoints, all the rest of that kind of stuff just comes to you for free.
So this is going to be a playground for the guys that wrote Boo to go, because I've looked at the, if you look at the code, if you take some, you know, Boo from Codehouse, if you look at their stuff, which is a, you know, Python kind of Rust-friendly CLI language, and if you look at their stuff in Reflector, they're doing a lot of compiler generation, and they're doing some funky stuff in there. They're going to be able to kind of throw all that away because a lot of those services around dynamic dispatch are going to be available to them in the DLR.
Yeah, I think Oren's already posted a little bit, and he's looking forward to playing Oren with the DLR more. Certainly, you know, one of the goals that we kind of have from the dynamic language runtime is, you know, to be able to do a talk at some point at, you know, a future PDC or a future lang.net conference, where you can actually start at the very beginning of the talk and start define a language on stage, and then you can actually code it and actually have it up and running, working inside Silverlight, having it work inside ASP.NET, and having it work inside WPF.
Well, I wonder how long it's going to take for somebody to hack together a PowerShell ASP.NET dynamic language thing.
I probably won't take too long at all, actually.
Yeah, I suspect it probably won't take very long at all.
Yeah. So, the key thing for us, you know, again, the thing we're trying to enable, you know, like, you know, why use the CLR? It's like, well, you get to use, you know, RGC, our just-in-time compiler. It's world-class. And now you get to essentially use Jim Hoogan and his code and, you know, John Lamb and all the code he's contributing and just bring that on top of yours. So it makes it really, really simple.
So in the past, when I've tried to do kind of a poor man's code generation, a poor man's dynamicism within the CLR, I do reflection.emit and code dump stuff, and I usually end up leaking assemblies. I can't get assemblies kicked out and stuff. And then with .NET 2.0, there was introduction of the dynamic method.
Yeah, it's the lightweight code gen, or LCG for short.
So you're basically kind of creating programmer intent, wrapping it around this handle and calling it a dynamic method, and they get garbage collected just like any other object.
That's right. It's kind of like I have this piece of IL, and I'd like to trade that for a function pointer, please. right? And which is really nice in a kind of malleable dynamic environment where you're defining, redefining methods, et cetera. That was actually a feature that was put into version 2.0 of the CLR way back when in order to support dynamic languages. And so then Jim was able to come along, do IronPython 1.0, you know, you leverage that and a bunch of other code. And, you know, that's essentially what you get. Because if you just try and do this work yourself, it can be, you know, kind of hard to figure out what the tricks are, how to make it performant and things like that. And that's what the DLR does for you. It just does a lot of that heavy lifting. You can just hook up to it.
Yeah, Oren's going to love that, the Boo guys. So when you're doing a lot of dynamic code generation like that, how do you balance that with security and safety? I know there's probably a new security model within Silverlight, but also just the regular CLR, and you've got IL being jitted left and right here.
Yeah. Well, the important thing there is you're still using IL, and you're still using the type safe, you know, subsystem inside of the CLR. So we're still going to run the verifier, you know, when appropriate and based on your usual security settings and things like that. And so you get all those same kind of benefits, right? And that is the advantage of having the, you know, the managed code system there for you. And as you mentioned, in Silverlight, there's actually a new, pretty simple, straightforward sandbox security model. We will be bringing that forward onto the desktop CLR as well, so that your apps, again, when you write it for Silverlight and you decide at some point, wow, I'd really love to add, you know, 3D and full WPF, you can quite easily just take that code and move it forward. So there's been a lot of innovation around security in this release. It's something we haven't even talked about too much yet, but I'll probably be doing follow-ups on blogs and stuff over the next few weeks.
Very cool. Do you see that there are a lot of people who've done a lot of crazy stuff in JavaScript? When I say crazy stuff, I don't mean that it's necessarily bad or to be pejorative, but they've taken JavaScript and just squeezed it so much that they've built entire engines. I'm not talking specifically about Ajax, but whole object models and realizations in the browser. How compliant is the ECMAScript support that's going to get jitted versus the stuff on the outside, such that someone could take good JavaScript and an engine on the client side and put that in and suddenly get a 1000x speed up?
A couple of different things. You will be able to go ahead and use our JavaScript compiler, right? I think the big key thing for developers that we're going to have to sort through is, you know, how compatible can we make that code when we go off and do it? Obviously, you know, the one nice thing about JavaScript, it's, you know, it's been in, you know, IE, Firefox, et cetera, for a long time. It's kind of standardized, et cetera. And anytime you come along with a new code system or language, that's usually the trickiest part, is to get that there. So we will have the performance, as you mentioned, with the compiled code on top of it. But we're going to work through the guidance, and, you know, what we won't recommend is saying, hey, just go drop this thing in, replace everything. We're going to have a more gradual kind of set of guidance there.
As appropriate, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we know that JScript.dll and its history, it's been around for a very long time, and there's a lot of people that feel that, you know, JScript, because of the way it was architected and some of the COM background around the scripting languages and the plugins and how it was reused with classic ASP, it's a little slow, particularly in its interactions with the DOM. How are Silverlight, and Silverlight's now going to be allowed to reach out of itself and into the DOM, as well as JavaScript code in the browser outside of Silverlight reaching back in. So there's this kind of this seamless bridge between two type systems. How does that work, and how is that performant?
Yeah, well, so we basically, there's two features that call out. One is, we do have a managed DOM API now that ships with Silverlight. And so you can go ahead and use any .NET language inside Silverlight. You can use C#, you can use VB, you can use Python, Ruby, JavaScript. And from within .NET code, you can go ahead and just say HTML page.html document, and you have a reference to the HTML document that the Silverlight control is being hosted on. And so you can create elements, you can get access to elements, you can do, it's a DOM API, so you can get element by ID and get a reference to it. You can also, and this is kind of really cool, is if you, for example, reach out and grab a button, a reference to a button, you can also attach a managed event to that button. And so you can reach any HTML element and wire up any event that typically you do in JavaScript and wire up a .NET delegate to it. And so if you want to, you really have the complete capability to interact with HTML in a rich way.
That's hot.
It's pretty cool. And that works cross-browser, so, and cross-platform. So yeah. That's not just an IE thing. That works in Firefox. It works in Safari. And
so then there's a dispatch mechanism within some of the AG host JavaScript, then it must be watching.
It's not an AG host, but it's
event
in,
bubbling or
it's,
something.
It's in the plugin.
Yeah. The plugin is watching what's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize they had that kind of power. Yeah. Plugins can do a lot.
Yeah, plugins can do a lot.
How can they go full screen? I thought that was kind of creepy.
Plugins do have the ability to go full screen. So one of the demos that we showed, or a couple of demos we showed, was the ability for people to effectively go completely full screen and do some pretty neat interactions as a result. Yeah, and one of the nice things also about the full screen is you can go ahead and not only run video in snippets, but you can actually run the video over the entire thing. And so you can actually do full screen video with Silverlight. And even cooler, and it's one of the things that the Major League Baseball folks showed on Monday, is you can actually overlay text as well as controls and rich UI, any UI you want built with WPF, on top of the video while you're running full screen. And that just really lets you build some mind-boggling UI experiences.
And I noticed when they did that, they would go to full screen and they'd look at the video and they'd go back in the – and it wouldn't actually restart like with Windows Media Player, where it's like, oh, I've gone full screen and we're going to start all over again. I got to seek.
Yep. So, yeah, we don't have to restart. And you can even go ahead and actually resize the video dynamically. So it's not just full screen or minimized. You can actually say, like, I'm going to expand the video by, 5% every second. And the video stream does not stop. It does not pause. It does not restart. You get a completely smooth experience. And that's, again, across all platforms, all browsers.
And back to the JavaScript kind of CLR bridge and this seamlessness that's going on. Could that I know that every new technology gives someone potentially more rope to hang themselves with. Mm-hmm. But people are doing a lot of threadings and more in the client. And now you've got two different threading models, the JavaScript on the outside and the JavaScript on the inside. They could both potentially listen to events, be poking at buttons. One could probably get themselves into a bit of a problem.
Well, from a threading perspective, you're actually handling all the events on the same UI thread. And so the way the browser works is, if you have two buttons with two event handlers, you can't run into a situation where you click both real quickly and both events fire. You'll actually be executing on the same thread.
So there aren't two UI threads?
No, there's only one UI thread typically for browsers. Now, what Silverlight will enable you to do is create background threads. And so if you want to be able to do something computationally intensive in the background, there will be a model for you to go ahead and do that within Silverlight. And then you can basically post an event. That the UI thread can then go ahead and handle. So once you finish with that, you can go ahead and update the UI.
Can poorly behaved JavaScript in the browser outside Silverlight affect the UI thread enough that the Silverlight would have trouble doing its video? There's the browser WinFrame, there's the client area that's rendered, and then there's kind of the execution thread of the browser proper.
In theory, if you had like an infinite loop in your JavaScript, that could affect obviously the
It has nothing to do with Silverlight. I'm just thinking more about just generally, because the potential not only for using the client for more serious computations now becomes kind of pretty significant, but also the ability for concurrency to be doing one thing while doing another. I mean, we were watching the Top Banana demo during the keynote, and he had 9 videos going simultaneously while moving a scroll bar over on the left. And I'm trying to think to myself, how much concurrency and state is he having to manage, and how much of this is just being handled by the intrinsic media functionality built into Silverlight? It appears that playing video is trivial. It's just handled. You just say, hey, play it. You don't have to worry about anything. It manages state.
Yeah, there's built into both full-blown WPF and then also the WPF on Silverlight is a media element control. And basically with the media element control, you can go ahead and point to kind of any type of media file, including a WMV video file. And there's an object model for playing, pausing, stopping, seeking, for that. And so in this Top Banana app, which you can actually go to www.silverlight.net, and I believe we have a video up of just that, and a nice high-res video if you want to watch it. But it's pretty stunning. And, the nice thing is all of the actual, graphics performance is encapsulated inside that media element control. And so, all he did in his app is say, play, play, play on the 9 of them. And, Silverlight handles the rest.
I think from, using the concurrency on the client, you have the nice thing, which is system.threading. So it's the same APIs you're already familiar with. And I think the very common usages are going to be if you're going to do intense, numerical crunching or a big algorithm analytics, take your pick, you can go kick off a thread to do that. Another interesting one will be things like, hey, I'd like to go make a web service call. It may, have a lot of latency associated with it. It may take a long time to, stream in. So this gives me an opportunity to kick off that background thread, be pulling in results, processing them, kind of queuing them up for the UI piece. That's the sort of thing I think you'll wind up using. And people do try and do that today with JavaScript with a wacky combination of, kind of timers and other sort of things. I think that gets to, it's hard to write that kind of code. It's hard to debug it and get it right. So having that powerful just threading model with .NET there for you, works great. And then the media controls encapsulate all the other hard work. So the two is very powerful.
And you bring up a good point that you're saying that there's the threading classes that we're used to. It may not be the actual BCL system.threading that, exact same code, but it's behaving the same, right? It's the same public interface. It may have Silverlight specific things, but like just as there's system.io.isolated storage, right? Is that the same isolated storage? It's probably no. It's probably Silverlight specific for the security model.
In general, what we did is we went through again, looked at the scenarios, came from the core up, decided what the min bar was. In a lot of cases, we actually just factored the existing code. That's the case for the core CLR itself, and it's the case for a bunch of the framework libraries as well. In other cases, we said, well, what's unique about being in the browser? Right, and I have XML, HTTP. I have other kind of services for the browser, and so we took some of the same, API contracts. Gives you the same behavior, like you mentioned, but we may have plumbed some of those in through the environment that we live in. So there's a little mixture of both, and in every case, it was what's the right thing for what the developer wants to accomplish in this environment, and that's how we did it.
So I don't know if this is an appropriate analogy, but tell me if my thinking is right. For a while, I would write code on 1.0, 1.1, and I'd make sure they compiled and worked on both. And then there was a time when I'd write code on 1.1 and 2.0 and maybe mono. And you want to just basically pick the intersection of the base class library. Is that same thinking that we could do? And it's totally appropriate, even encouraged to write assemblies and take that exact same DLL and use it on the server side, use it on the client side, using that subset of intersected base class library.
Yes.
Functionality.
Yeah, I mean, even what we've tried to do in Silverlight is, you know, I think if you look at the number of classes we have, I haven't actually counted them, but it's probably 1,200 or something. We have some pretty rich libraries, including, for example, Link. So if you have some business logic and you have some collections of objects that are, you know, generic collections, and, you know, you've got computational, you've got some validation logic or anything like that, you know, you can express that using Link and some of the functional programming constructs that it provides. You can do all the querying, you can do all the data modeling, and yeah, that assembly will work in any .NET environment.
There's so many people out in the hallway now that mostly, from my point of view, the developers that are thinking about, is this going to be, you know, is this, whatever they're thinking about, the way to do something. Like one guy said, well, we'll take our HTML forms and we'll squirrel them off into a Silverlight that'll be like a 1 pixel by 1 pixel Silverlight. It won't have any UI. We'll load up the object and then send it across via web services. And this is how they're going to exploit their web services stuff.
So, I mean, certainly you could do that.
You can do a lot of things.
You can do a lot of things. So you can absolutely have a HTML page that has no WPF UI on it at all, and, you know, use the both the HTML DOM APIs inside Silverlight. The other thing that's kind of cool though is Silverlight allows you to expose public static methods on your root container class, and you can then go ahead and decorate those methods and say they are script serializable. And that means that you can actually, from JavaScript in the browser, so again, using the native JavaScript that ships with the browser, you can actually construct JavaScript objects and call those public static methods that might be written in C#, and we'll actually serialize the JavaScript to and from those methods.
This is like a method missing for JavaScript?
JavaScript's all
right,
laid-bound.
It's got its whole laid-bound thing. Cool. I keep putting things in Ruby terms, but
yeah.
I just decide I want a function be called foo. I'm going to call it from JavaScript, yep. And when I say foo, it's happening in managed code.
Correct. And if you pass in, for example, a couple strings or an integer or an array of objects, we can actually serialize back and forth. And we're actually reusing the same serialization technology that we used where they spent AJAX on the server as part of our JSON marshalling code. But the cool thing is we're actually marshalling we're marshalling to and from native .NET types. And that provides another easy way that, you know, if you want to go ahead and you have something computationally intensive in the browser, you can actually, yeah, if you want to, you can host a Silverlight control that has no UI and just call into it and use the CLR engine to basically process it.
And it seems like you can scale up your use of Silverlight. I mean, if you're mm-hmm. using the example you just gave as a really simple one, you know, maybe I'm a scientist and I've got something really hardcore going on and I want to just add a computational engine and do some more distributed computing. Mm-hmm. Suddenly Silverlight without UI is doing distributed computing. Then I decide to put some visualizations in and maybe I go to a 100% by 100%. Mm-hmm. Silverlight fills the screen and I'm kind of, you know, living the whole rich media lifestyle and go mm-hmm. all the way up and down that whole.
Yeah. And the WPF UI framework that will ship in Silverlight, you know, will be a rich framework. Today in the alphabets, it is very much focused on visualization and some of the core primitives that we need in order to build higher level controls. We don't have many higher level controls yet. You'll see those controls start to appear now that we have the core bases there. And you'll see constructs like the WPF layout managers, data binding, you know, eventually a data grid, and those types of controls appear. They're not all there yet, but it does provide a really good foundation today with today's build, as well as a control encapsulation model such that you can build those types of components. You know, I definitely recommend people do take a look at WPF because it is a very exciting technology. One thing, going back to your threading comments, in terms of how, you know, the top banana video editor app was able to, you know, display things as sort of stunning and as in real time as it looked, is that WPF is what we call a retained mode graphics engine, which means that when you actually paint something on the screen, you don't have to manually write any code to repaint it. WPF and the whole model does that for you automatically. So it's different than, say, Win32 or User GDI, which made it much more harder to do that. The other thing that we've done with our WPF implementation in Silverlight is it is very much optimized to take advantage of as many cores or processors you have on the system. And so if you have two cores, and, you know, going forward, pretty much every machine will have two cores or more cores, you automatically get a really rich UI framework that is designed to maximize and take advantage of that. And that is also one of the reasons why you can build such stunning graphics using Silverlight.
Yeah, is that usage of multiple cores, is that a WPF aspect of Silverlight, or that's a new thing in the core CLR?
The CLR does take advantage of multiple cores with things like garbage collection and things like that. But from a graphics perspective and from a UI framework perspective, that is certainly something we're doing with Silverlight and the full WPF going forward. And, you know, there's a number of this is a good blog post I should do, but there's a number of things that we're doing across .NET, both a UI layer, but also with things like Link, that by going to a mode where you're not actually telling us what to do, you're actually describing what you'd like to have done. So with XAML, you don't say paint this pixel, you say I want a rectangle here of this dimension. And with Link, you don't say search the for loop, you know, don't do a for loop. I say I want to have something that meets this criteria. By doing more declarative intent, you know, the CLR and .NET and our higher level frameworks will be able to go ahead and optimize appropriately across multiple cores.
Does Silverlight act any different on Vista with the desktop compositing engine? I mean, it's painting. It's constrained to what the browser can do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I think I'd asked this question to you casually in the hall. The idea that if you use the accessibility magnifier and you hover over a WPF app like the New York Times Reader, you get beautiful anti-aliased stuff. But if the WPF engine in Silverlight is different and living within the browser, if you take the Vista magnifier over that, you'll probably get rasters. You probably get bitmaps.
Yeah, you asked that yesterday. I haven't had a chance to try it out, so I'm not sure.
I haven't got a Vista box lying around. You know what I'm asking about, though, don't you, Jason?
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're asking about.
I mean, it's not a big deal, but it sure is an interesting question because it tells you how it's a nice experiment, right? Because I don't have the code. So as a scientist, I have to use a scientific method to glean what I think is going on inside.
Yeah, the key thing with WPF on the desktop, especially with Vista, you know, Vista introduced a new driver model, and it made it much easier to, you know, do this kind of cooperative, you know, graphics processing on the machine. And so, you know, you get full hardware acceleration and other things like that. And so that's one of the advantages you're going to get with the desktop version of WPF. In this case, Silverlight is optimized for, you know, cross-plat, giving you reach, et cetera. But it shares a lot of the same, you know, graphics, you know, techniques underneath of that.
See, that's very, very good information because you're starting to give me and hopefully other folks enough information to decide what tool is right for the job. Like I've always wondered about the XBAP, right? The XAML browser-based applications. And I've always thought it was kind of this redheaded stepchild, but you just right then made me realize that if I was doing a browser-based 3D accelerated application that did protein folding or something, and I wanted it to be, and I didn't want it to be a one-touch deploy jump out of the browser. I wanted a Silverlight-like experience and a very minimal installation, then an XBAP would be totally appropriate for that. I would get all the hardware acceleration and all of the full WPF desktop experience inside the browser.
Yeah, certainly, you know, the way we've been thinking about Silverlight, and this is, I think, an important point for people to understand, is that all the APIs and the features in Silverlight are absolutely designed to be cross-platform. And we won't be adding in features to Silverlight that we can't consistently expose on all platforms. And so developers can know, hey, if I write to this subset, it will work in all browsers and in all platforms. You know, there will always be richer features that we can use that are platform specific, like 3D hardware acceleration, you know, like richer, you know, database support and things like that. And those, you know, obviously the .NET framework and the Windows, you know, and things like XBAPs and full WPF applications on the client will be able to take advantage of. And certainly we see that there are different types of apps that people build. Sometimes they want it to be as ubiquitous as possible. Silverlight's the way to go for client apps. And sometimes you want to take as much maximum reach of the operating system you're running on and the system, whether it's Office integration, whether it's 3D, whether it's offline support. You know, there's a whole bunch of other good reasons there. You know, and they're obviously the full .NET framework with WPF, either running in XBAP mode or outside the browser is really appropriate, is the best, is absolutely the right thing to do.
Cool. People are stoked. People's brains are exploding. One guy blogged. He's like, wow, I have learning to do. He's been kind of sitting around, you know, just coding C# for a few years. Like, this is the biggest thing since .NET 1.0, as far as I'm concerned.
We're pretty excited about it. It's been, you know, Jason and I have been working on this for, you know, a year now. And it's great to, you know, finally be able to ship the bits and be able to talk about it and see people's reaction. Cause, you know, people were just stunned yesterday, and it's always fun to have that reaction.
Yeah, the future is bright. I really appreciate you guys taking the time out of your day. I know you're scheduled with an interview live, both of you guys talking to press and everybody. But thanks a lot for talking to us here on Hanselman.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.